Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedy is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host.
Actually, forgive me. Old habits die hard. Actually, this is PJ that we have for this evening.
No, it's not.
And of course, as always, though. Yes, Mr. Allen?
It's not PJ tonight. It's John.
Ah, forgive me.
And I started the recording.
Oh, okay.
Before we get into the disclaimer, though, we have a first-time caller from Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Would you kindly share with us how you heard about us? Ending in 7044, the phone.
That's Lancaster, New York, not Pennsylvania.
Sorry.
I have heard of you guys through Michael, and Michael and I used to talk back in 2017, and he invited me to the call tonight. So here I am.
Great. Well, I am Michael also, and your name?
My first name is John. Yeah, Cipolla.
Welcome, John. I know that person. Wonderful. Good to hear you, John.
Thank you.
Anyways, thank you. So, Martin, go ahead with your disclaimer, if you would, please.
All right, very good. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you're on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everybody in no uncertain terms that anybody looking for legal advice has no place or business here on any of these calls. Nobody here at Your Remedy is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just folks saying what they might do. Were they similarly situated to you? You might get a little bit of education out of the deal. Get some experience from folks that what they've been through, storytelling, if you will. But that's about the extent of it. Again, if you require any kind of actual legal advice, you'd have to get an attorney. All right. If I can draw everybody's attention to the homepage of Your Remedy is in the Law, www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com. We look up in the upper right-hand corner. We see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up. It's got two items on it, an otherwise blank page. Just two only items there. But these items are of much, much importance, especially if this is all new to you. On the left is the Jurisdictionary course, your 24-hour crash course on American jurisprudence, better known to some as AMJUR. What this is essentially is the foundation upon which all law in America rests, American jurisprudence is. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of it, to have diligently devoured this course multiple times, I would suggest. Once you've got that sort of pretty tight now, that would mean that you would have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in really virtually any court scenario that you would find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process. Of course, some of you folks say the common law default process, that's for traffic tickets. Yes, that is what it's primarily known for. That's what most people acquire this course for. So it's a very, very high win rate national. High win rate. But that's not why it's here. The reason that it's here is, again, especially if this is new to you, once you've gone through the jurisdictionary course and you start in on the common law default process, you'll see very quickly that it lines up. It mirrors almost perfectly. It acts as really as a real-life homework assignment. So you've gone through your jurisdictionary course. Now you're doing the common law default and those basic pillars that core of how this all works, you're now exercising it out through the common law default process. And of course, with the common law default process being primarily used for traffic court scenarios, and of course, traffic court is such a common thing that we see in this country. We find it also helps folks that are new because traffic scenarios are thankfully usually more times than not, they're usually lesser severity situations. And so if things don't go exactly according to plan, it's usually not the end of the world. So folks feel a little bit braver, I guess I should say, and they're more happy to use that to get their feet wet. And now with the generous asking of just a contribution of $250 for the jurisdictionary course and $150 for the common law default process, we strongly encourage you to those up at your absolute earliest convenience. All right, on to the next subject. If we look on the homepage of Your Remedy is in the Law, of course, every time we go to Your Remedy is in the Law, that little flag pops up, a little box pops up and asks if we want to continue on where we were requesting to go, or would we mind stopping, taking a moment and checking out Americans Restoring America. We've done this really because we're wanting to get folks to explore. Your Remedy is in the Law is, of course, under the blanket of Americans Restoring America. We have many different information providers providing many different educational processes. And then all of that just being Your Remedy is in the Law. And then there are multiple sites, I want to say about like a dozen, that are all under Americans Restoring America. So there's a tremendous amount there to digest, a lot of many wonderful different educational tools and processes. And so, again, at your earliest convenience, we strongly encourage you to check out Americans Restoring America. Just kind of poke around, see if you see anything that piques your interest. Most folks do. So, if you haven't already as well, go ahead and pick up a membership to Your Remedies in the Law. Also, a very, very affordable contribution of $10 a month. There are so many extra goodies that you get there with that $10 membership. Primarily, the archives. The archives. Now, some of you folks may be familiar with Freedoms Radio. If you're not, something else for you to check out there, freedomsradio.com. Every single call that we have is broadcasted out over Freedoms Radio. So by the way, if you find yourself in a situation where you don't want to dial into the call that night, maybe you're in a hurry, maybe you're traveling over, out of the road, just jump on Freedoms Radio and enjoy these calls. Now, of course, Freedoms Radio is no cost to you. So every single call, every night, you can enjoy those calls without any contributions. But that membership there that we were just speaking about, Your Remedies in the Law, contribution of $10 a month, one of the biggest things with that you're going to pick up is now the get to the archives for all the previous calls. So all the different information providers that we've had, all the different topics over all the years, just an untold vast wealth of knowledge there and experience. Lots and lots and lots of opinions to be heard, lots of two cents. You now have unlimited access to that with your $10 a month contribution for the Your Remedy membership. And so we encourage you to get on that too at your earliest convenience. All right. On to the next topic, Brassfire Communications, formerly known as Statewide Communications. Not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends, tell your family about it. What it is a private communications platform that enables you to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict, pre-decided topics of discussion. By the way, that's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every page, every website that we have. How it works, essentially, is you've got a very user-friendly, very easy-to-navigate setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your address in here, click next. As you get to the end, it's going to ask you to pick from quite a healthy list of different topics. What are the ones that interest you? Pretty much no matter what the scenario is, we've got the topic, or we've got that that topic there in the list. Whether it's veterans' rights, credit cards, home foreclosures, IRS matters, on and on and on. You can find it in that list. And so then when it's all done, wraps it all up and gives it back to you, much like a lot of folks would say is, like it feels like a social media, but really nothing like a social media. It's very, very private, very, very secure. And so it's going to put you in contact with people right there in your local area that have the same interests that you do. And so if you're just hearing about this, you can imagine, the impact that that could have. Not just with education, but, with, political matters as well. So there's no contribution required for that either. So we encourage you to sign up for that today. All right. Let's start winding down here. This next portion is called your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. When you come aboard with an information provider, you decide to do so, come aboard with an information provider here at your remedies in the law, you're doing just that. Information providers pay your remedies in the law to advertise there on that site. That would be an expense to that information provider, along with any other expenses that that info provider has associated with your particular educational process. We always hope for the best. We plan for the best. But believe you me, we aim for the best. If you have any questions of that, I encourage you to check out yourremediesinthelaw.com/testimonials, and you'll see very quickly what we mean by that. But, in life, sometimes things happen. And when they do, we have to roll with them and deal with them like we do with anything else in life. But that brings us to the topic of the refund policy, as your remedy isn't long. There is none. Again, when you're coming aboard with an information provider, you're doing just that. You're going with that information provider. And so, for example, if there was to be any talk of a refund or a credit or anything like that, that would be a strict and private matter, just between you and your information provider. But I can tell you, folks, that's few and far between. It has to be some pretty extenuating circumstances. Again, as always, you're expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to an information provider's time. All right, one last thing here. These information providers, these speakers on our calls are our guests. And please, they should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that one of our speakers has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn. It's part of the process. But there's never a reason to not be friendly and courteous. Besides, if a question is posed properly, and then it's answered properly, then we all get to learn something from it. All right, well, that is my ramble for this evening, folks. Without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and turn the call back over here very briefly to Mr. Edward, and he will introduce our speaker for this evening.
Great. Thank you, Martin. I appreciate that. How many of you have heard the phrase, motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim upon which relief may be granted?
I have.
You know what it is? Yeah. You know what it is? A motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim is a defense asserting that even if all the factual allegations in a complaint are true, they're insufficient to establish a legal cause of action. In civil court, a lawsuit is initiated by the filing of the complaint. If a lawsuit is filed against you or someone you know, there is no legal relationship between you and the plaintiff, well, that would give rise to the claim for relief, a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim upon which relief may be granted. When the complaint is filed, it alleges claims against the defendant. The defendant has certain options in how to respond to these claims. The defendant may answer the complaint and admit the allegations, or the defendant may deny the allegations, or the defendant can attack the complaint about its insufficiency, usually by a motion to dismiss. Now, in Denver, Colorado courts, once a lawsuit has been initiated by the filing of a complaint which alleges claims against the defendant, that defendant has certain options to respond to those claims. Generally speaking, the defendant can either answer those claims in an appropriately labeled pleading called an answer, whereby the defendant responds to each paragraph of the complaint, either admitting or denying the allegations, or the defendant can attack the complaint for insufficiency, usually by a motion to dismiss. In essence, filing a motion to dismiss alleges that there is some sort of a critical deficiency within the complaint, and the claims alleged in the complaint or the actual procedure on how the lawsuit was initiated, and correspondingly requests the specific claims alleged or the entire lawsuit be dismissed. A successful motion to dismiss allows the defendant an opportunity to have the lawsuit dismissed essentially before it has even begun, and that's nice. That is, before the defendant has to answer the alleged claims and before discovery has been initiated. Typically, motions to dismiss are filed under the Colorado Rules of Civil Procedure. Under these procedures, there are six main motions, basis to file a motion to dismiss, and these are powerful. Number one, lack of jurisdiction over the subject matter. Now, how many of you recall that we're talking about on the Monday night call the bench requiring, upon challenge, the prosecutor to establish on the record the land this incident occurred on? Is it property of the United States or is it property of one of the Union states? Second is lack of jurisdiction over the person, persona jurisdiction. Same thing. Again, the status question comes up that we talked about last night's call. And it goes on to insufficiency of process, insufficiency of service of process, failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted, and failure to join an indispensable party to the claim. That's perfect for a lot of foreclosures, home foreclosures. So without further ado, we're going to turn this call over to Brother John, and he's going to masticate this for you and hopefully give you something delectable to chew upon. Without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn the call over to Brother John. Go ahead, buddy.
Thank you for your kind and gracious introduction, Michael. This evening, we're going to talk, as Michael pointed out, failure to state a claim for which relief can be granted. You know, Michael's point about you can have all these facts and they can be all correct, and the other party can be dead wrong. But if you fail to state what you want the court to do, they can't do anything. And there are many, many, many cases that have gone to gone all the way many into and run into years. And the difficulty that what happens is that they fail to tell the court, even though they know they've been wrong, they've stated the facts. Look, this guy, he trespassed, he drove over my lawn, he drove, into my backyard, he broke my septic tank in, and this, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, you can state all these facts, but if you don't tell the court in your opening, when you file a pleading, it's required, and that you file a brief statement, a summary of the claim, and that which you're, that then the relief you're seeking. So it's, what happens is that, most individuals, that I've seen that have run into legal barricades fail right up front to methodically think through the process that, okay, Your Honor, this person trespassed and did some, or the Honorable Court, this person trespassed. They were driving a vehicle when they trespassed. And I would like relief from the damages, to be compensated for the damages that they caused. And, I would also like, punitive damages so that, we slap their hands so they don't do it again. There's, when it comes to damages that, that you're seeking, there's, multiple kinds of damages, that you can, seek relief for. The thing that's very, important is that, the thing that's very, very critical is that there's compensatory, incidental, consequential, normal, and liquidated and sometimes punitive damages. But the compensatory damages are the ones that you're most looking for. And possibly, you know, the punitive damages. And punitive is just like what it sounds. If somebody gets their hand slapped and it stings bad enough that they don't go out and do it again. And, but the thing is, in a civil case, when you're seeking punitive damages, you can get to keep the damages. So that, you had to pay the lawn guy to remove the, tire tracks, to resod the lawn. You had to pay the septic guy to dig up the old tank, which got damaged, and put in a new one, or maybe just the lid. And, then you had to cover the time, you know, your other damages and the plumbing that was damaged. That's compensatory damages. The thing is very, 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 very important is that you understand, the types of damages that you're looking at so that you can write or seek with an attorney the pleading that you're, that you know what in advance you're looking for. Some people are very naive and innocent at jurisprudence. And to that end, they're hurt. They know they've been hurt. That guy drove across their lawn. Gosh, that's abominable. He trespassed. There was a no trespassing sign out there. And he got his truck stuck in the, with the one wheel into the septic tank, broke in lid, and then the tow truck drug him sideways across the, you know, to get him out of there, and they had to take down part of the fence because the tow truck wasn't going to drive onto the soft lawn where the four-wheeler had already done all that damage to. And what happens is that they know they've been hurt, and they complain to the attorneys. And usually an attorney or somebody pleading the case for them will try to figure out what and how they can skillfully get them compensated for the damages. The thing that you have to remember is that every time that attorney has to think, you have to spend. There was a couple of professors at law that commented, and they literally, well, it wasn't commented, they ground our bones with it. This is back in the 70s and early 80s. And, they both of them, it was bizarre how they used the same terms. Conflict equals cash and bill on the 10th, meaning that every 6 minutes you get charged another 10th of an hour. They don't charge you by the hour, per se. You know, when you finally accumulate an hour, they book it out. What happens is that every 6 minutes, the little cabbie's bell ringy thingy goes ding, you know, and you owe a few more pennies or maybe even a nickel or a shiny dime. And a lot of attorneys right now, their standard rate is $2.75 or $3.75 an hour. And so, you know, if you're going to talk, you're going to be they'll gleefully listen. In fact, they'll let you talk till you're blue in the face. But if you can sort it out in advance when you're seeking help, you may even be able to not just reduce, but may even be able to figure it out so that you can file a complaint pro se or jury juris, meaning that you have rightful standing to file. There's at this juncture, while Michael was referring to the Colorado statutes, I'm going to back up to the federal statutes. And Michael literally all but, you know, had he been quoting it, it would have been quoted out of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, and it would have been 12 B 1 through 6 or 7 are the and there's literally Rule 12 part of it on B is how to present defenses, and it tells you literally it's it's A is time to serve a responsive pleading, and 21 days Monday or 20 days Monday next or timely served, you know, and then et cetera, waivers. And it talks about everything you need to know is in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure on filing, the FRCP. If you have a question, you can do a search using any one of your search engines and look up just the acronym FRCP. Or, you know, if you have questions with your search engine, type in Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. And I do recommend reading some of those, especially if you consider the possibility that you may be involved in litigation. Attorneys and liars, and you can spell that, you know, sometimes I've listened to the controversy about how they spell the term liar, whether it's L-A-W-Y-E-R or L-I-A-R, which kind of bleeds back to the Jim Carrey movie. But they go to school and do a lot of studying to learn how to act, support themselves, and understand the law. Now, the problem with that is that they're not fine civic social, civic-minded citizens. They're in it for the money. And so to the money issue, the first thing that these two professors used to grind our bones was conflict equals cash. When there's a problem, that's an opportunity for income. And just like most doctors, that if the doctor heals you of that itch and that rash, if he gives you the correct medicine or a homeopathic remedy and that itch or rash goes away and the related pain, you'll never come back and see him. You're never going to spend another nickel with him. That's kind of counterproductive. But if he kind of, instead of solving the problem, salves the symptoms, gives you something to put on, itch cream, anti-itch cream, something, an analgesic for the swelling, anti-inflammatory, and then something for the pain, analgesic for the pain, some sort of pain medication, but he never gives you that one little pill that takes away the rash and the inflammation below the tissue surface that is causing the problem. You may spend the rest of your life coming to him once a month, or now under the new federal FDA guidelines, you must see the physician for prescribing physician every 90 days for renewal, which is unconstitutional. It's illegal, but it is currently the FDA statute, and almost every doctor complies with it for one simple reason. It brings them regular business. And so you'll be in there for the rest of your life. Same thing with attorneys. There was a gentleman who was coming up to sentencing and for wrongful carry of a firearm in California. We were out there a little while back, and I wasn't able to actually go to the hearing myself, but they were coming up the sentencing phase, and so we did challenge jurisdiction. And we challenged jurisdiction with the simple question, where in the Constitution to exclude his right to keep bear a firearm in that park? And this was MacArthur Park downtown in L.A. there where it happened, or excuse me, Elysian Park. And the attorney, turns out, for the defense, was the grandson of somebody that I was at law with in the 70s. About 2 days after the trial ended, which ended on a Friday, it was a Sunday, I was getting ready to leave to go to the airport. I was out visiting my father who's dying out there. And I met with James, bought him lunch, and he was a little miffed because, he says, you realize I estimate that I still had 14 to 20 hours that I could have made on that case had you not given that gentleman that question to ask. He wouldn't settle down. He wouldn't even let me review the pleading. And I said, James, so what is the problem? He says, well, you realize I'm charging him $325 an hour. He says, I had probably $6,000 to $7,000 more that I could have gotten out of that case, if you wouldn't have given that to him. He says, I'm very upset with you. I says, you understand I went to school with your grandfather, and we had both Justice Phillips and Justice Winehurst, as professors when we were at law. He goes, oh yeah, Grandpa tells me about it, and so does Dad. Dad actually had one of them. He was before they retired. And I says, so what about true justice? And he looked up at me as he was finishing his plate that I bought dinner, or the lunch, actually. A very nice one, actually. Lobster. He looked at me. He says, there is no such thing as justice. This is a business. I'm here to feed my family. And I said, James, would your grandfather be proud of you to hear you say that? He goes, look, Mr. Fiala, it's a fact. He says, look, sir, you have no idea what it's like in California to feed your family. And he says, that's what this is. It's an industry. He says, medicine's an industry. And he quoted to me that something similar to what I just shared with you about if the doctor feels you, you're out the door and you don't have to come visit him anymore. And he says, I'm struggling to since I got my own shingle, I'm struggling to keep my practice afloat. He says, it's not easy. He says, in California, the cost of living is so abominable that my paralegals, that I'm paying them $125 an hour, just for my bottom line paralegals. And what happens is that he commented that he enjoys when somebody comes to them and they know they've been injured, but they don't know how to get from point A to point B. He says He loves to rack up the time on the search and the research, doing the legal work for them. And this young gentleman says, you know, there are those that come to him that already have sorted out how to get from, or what it is from point A to point B. And they, some of them have written out a summary, and they know what's wrong, and they know what to ask the court for. And so, he says, I said, so are those good or bad? And I was testing the waters. He says, well, I don't make very much money on them, but he says it is kind of consoling to be actually help do some good just for somebody once in a while. And and it hit like a brick that, if you know what you need and you're able to explain to whoever's helping you, because all of us need help, you know, and even attorneys, some attorneys will even quote you, even an attorney who represents himself as a fool for a client. They, and the reason being is that the biggest reason, especially in a jury trial, if you go up and try to say you're a good guy to the jury, look, I'm a really good guy, versus somebody else walking up and saying, the defendant here is a really good guy, I know him personally, that's somebody else speaking to your character, not you ringing your own bell. It's very hard to ring your own bell on your character, especially on a character consideration. And that's one thing that sways juries. There are some attorneys that all they do is spend their lives picking juries. And they meet with the client and they figure out what the, and these attorneys are bought in by the regular litigator. These attorneys are not going to litigate it for them. They sit like a fly on the wall in the background and listen to the meeting with the client, and they determine what the client's mental demographic, emotional demographics are, and is the curb appeal and their presentation value in court. And they literally decide, what type of juror they've got. And on all these jurors, you know, when you get the jury summons, you know, it says, what do you do for a living? Are you retired? Are you a doctor, a dentist, a lawyer? Have you ever been convicted of a crime? Do you know anybody else has been convicted of a crime? Have you ever been sued, by a shoe salesman, you know, before? Or have you ever bought shoes from a traveling shoe salesman? Do you know anybody that is a traveling shoe salesman? And those questionnaires come out. The attorneys have a good idea of the basic demographic, of the juror, potential juror. And, contrary to, most, judges, there's not one judge in the court. There's 12 plus one or two alternates. And they don't like the fact that they're now, relieved of a lot of their duties. So they, make up rules and policies that, including jury instructions, that, that the jurors don't have to comply with at all. But they come in and they say, look, here's the jury instructions. You solemnly swear to uphold, you know, and do as I say. And I have literally, there was a criminal case, a couple of months ago. It was finally heard in December, where the, judge says to the jury, he made them swear an oath to do exactly what he said. So they had no latitude, to ask for other information or ask for other evidence. The, prosecutor had exculpatory evidence. And for those of you who don't know the definition of exculpatory evidence, that's evidence that, indefatigably, proves that the defendant is innocent, exonerates the defendant. You know, they say, look, this guy stole that guy's lawnmower. and the prosecutor has copies of the plane tickets to show that he was in Acapulco the whole week, and it was stolen, when the lawnmower was stolen in the middle of the week. But the prosecutor still went and prosecuted him. And there's things called prosecutorial immunity, and we're going to cover that on a different evening session. But what happens is that these guys, they're looking to see any way that they, if there's an angle that they can get more hours on a job, that they can be successful. And if you understand providing a claim for which relief can be granted, at least in a civil matter, what happens is that you can not only help whoever you're having. And while I do love and enjoy representing myself and doing things myself, and if someday, if you ever ask my wife, you'll find out that the most of the cases that I've been in, I've gone in and represented myself or my family myself on it. But there's one or two cases where I had a criminal charge, and I had a criminal charge of wrongful carry of a weapon, of a firearm. And the second time I had that, I spent $1,500 and hired an attorney, and I explained to him exactly what I was going to do, and he didn't agree with me. I says, you know what, give me my $1,500 back, you know. And he goes, no. He says, but you don't understand. I says, yes, I do. I says, you work for me, and that judge works for me. This is government, other people, by the poor people, for the people, and that judge is just hired help. And in fact, that judge is temp help. You're hired help. The judge is temp help. And this attorney was so shocked. I says, you do it the way I, and here's a contract to accept the $1,500. And so I knew what I wanted in advance, and I had the attorney sign the contract, you know, and it was my contract. He offered a he says, well, I've got a contract for you to sign. I says, you know what? If you don't want to sign this, have a nice day. And all of a sudden, you know, an hour and a half later, after I'm already come home, he calls me up and says, I signed it. I says, you want to fax me a copy of the signed contract and then mail the original to me? And a week and a half later, I was in court, and he did exactly as he was told. And so knowing how to get from point A to point B in a criminal matter is also extremely important. And in that case, I did ask that question, wherein in the Constitution is assumed the right to keep and bear a firearm. That, they were both wrongful carry of a firearm both times I was that I got arrested on that. And and it was dismissed. But I had the judge I listened to the gentleman that was pleading the case this time. Part of the reason was that I knew the judge personally, I didn't want to get into trouble. But there's times when part of your strategy for winning is to have somebody stand up for you and banner your cause so that you can look like the innocent party that you are. And and especially if it ends up to a jury, going to a jury there, juries look at individuals that are championing and defending somebody else's cause a whole lot better. I got chosen for jury duty just a little while back, and I didn't get selected, actually. I was an alternate. Didn't actually even go in, but I watched it on the internet, the trial, and you can do that. And literally, sometimes if you go watch some of these court cases, and a lot of the district courts now have all their proceedings online, and you can do a search engine on one of your search engines for your local court and find even the specific court where a friend might be having their case, And from the comfort of your computer, you can watch and see their case. It's extremely critical that you'll find this out by watching a case or two, that that everyone had watched at least one or two cases before you ever have to appear in court. One thing that I heartily recommend is just logging onto one of these websites, any one of them, and the U.S. District Court's there. You can find them with a search engine. You look up the district courts that are in your area, and you can usually get onto the stream and watch, and it's very educating. If you can state all the facts but cannot connect the dots between point A and point B, there's some individuals that have had very compelling cases, some of our students. There's one that for many years before he came to me, came to my purview, on his very good, his research capacities as far as jurisprudence goes, he makes most of the paralegals that I know pale in comparison. But this gentleman could never, ever, ever draw the line in his opening statement on the second page. Because the first page, you have the style and you identify the parties and comes now so-and-so here and after referred to as the plaintiff, and would show the honorable court the following, and on the second page, you should be able to make a short summary with the claim for relief that you're seeking and, how to, and what you need and what you want. Excuse me. My humble apologies for yawn. But what happens is that in these claims that they've been filing, the quick draw that most attorneys, and it's an Achilles heel of pro se filers and sui juris filers, that they fail to state the claim for which relief can be granted. And don't worry, it's much worse than you think. It's not just a case of, well, we didn't win. It's a case of you didn't point out how to get from point A to point B, and they ruled against you. And now that you figured out how to do it, many times they bring up a rule called res judicata, and meaning that it's previously been adjudicated. And so what happens is that to that end, now that it's res judicata, the fact that you or somebody else unskillfully generated a pleading without seeking without making a claim for which relief could be granted, what happens is that now, in the last 3 weeks, I've come across four cases. Three of them are people that have become my students in the last year or two, that I found out that in their history, the skeletons in their closet, this one widow, I could not seem to figure out why for the life of me I could not find relief and get the judge to rule and grant any grace for this widow. All of a sudden, I found out that I come to find that in the state court, somebody previously filed a case on behalf of the widow and threatened the judge with prosecution, holy kitty litter, Batman. They went and he went and charged everybody, threatened everybody with prosecution. And while on a call to the court clerk, the judge, who is female, and I don't know if she knew I was still online with the clerk, but she was using that SOB. He never stated a relief for which she could be granted. And he called me, he threatened me, he threatened that. And I was going to try to rule on that widow's behalf. And he never followed up. Had he, there were seven things that I ordered him to respond to. All of them were very easy. I looked it up. And he never responded to any one of them. And he made all these threats like a little junkyard dog, like a little lap dog barking at somebody. Made all these loud threats and complaints, but never stated a claim for which relief could be granted. And then when the judge tried even coaching him through correcting it, he didn't. He left the widow out there hanging in the wind. There's, I've got three other cases, two of them just in the last 90 days that have come to me, that this information has come to me that skeletons in the closets from pleadings that were improperly filed or lack of a claim for which relief could be granted. And what happened was that in one of these cases, I subsequently filed not one, but two. I prepared them for the, helped prepare them for the gentleman. He and I, we talked, you know, and actually I talked him through it, and he asked me, he says, well, what would you file, John, if you were going to do this? And I says, well, I might do something like this. I said, that's a good question. I'm glad you asked. And I roughed something out, and he took it and ran with it. And he not only took it and ran with it, but he made it even a little bit better. Twice I was so dismayed that there was no relief granted. 7 weeks ago, I found out that somebody like this little junkyard dog that we were talking about, a similar situation, antagonized the local attorneys in front of the judge, antagonized the judge, threatened. He says, look, this is under a federal statute. This is a federal criminal act. And because he never came back, now anyone in that court has bought up 18 U.S.C. 242 or 241, the judge immediately finds him in contempt. Because all these people have threatened him. This little junkyard dog was the one that started it, apparently. Threatened. Nobody ever came through. And now the prosecutors laugh when he complains about that. And it was all because he never made a claim for which relief could be granted. Another case that occurred in Florida in U.S. District Court in Tallahassee or Pensacola, I mean, multi-million, actually, it was a more than $1 billion suit. Good suit. Oh, good standing. Another situation where somebody claimed that the all of this wrong had occurred, had the facts cold, had everything dead to rights, including three U.S. District Court justices, two prosecutors, and you would not believe who all was involved in. A DAG, a deputy attorney general, and multi-billion-dollar suit when it was all totaled up, and it got dismissed. And they did not even try to correct him. He was so antagonistic in his approach that they just dismissed it. And all the time and all the money that went into that case, into preparing it, trying to get relief for this gentleman, all just evaporated. This gentleman claimed to be a honorable servant of the Most High King, but that didn't make a difference to these people, that person that was antagonizing them and not making a claim for which relief could be granted, it got so bad that they tried to figure out how to put this person in jail for the rest of their life. So when we make a claim, you know, and this person became antagonistic when they were not responding to him and saying, well, look, you know, this is this and these are the facts, and, you know, and he got really, really upset and couldn't figure it out that because he had rubbed the justice wrong, and they were suing, elected officials, they decided just not to bother to tell him what was going wrong. And it was explained to me quietly, because I happen to know another justice that knew these, and this other justice explained it to me. He says, John, there's no way that you're going to get anything past them, because that, this is not the first time that little junkyard dog and this gentleman who is now deceased, he was a, chief justice, in Eastern United States for many, many years, over 22 years before he retired, and, a U.S. District Court Chief Justice. And, he says, look, there's res judicata there. I says, that's not in any of the briefs. He says, no, they're not going to put it in there. They're so upset with this person that didn't do it right the first time, that the second time he got upset about it. And the second time he lost his temperance and was upset and angry, because the first time he ended up, doing a little bit of, he got a little vacation, at the Club Fed, a couple of years actually. And he allowed himself to get bitter. And to that end, he has a tack on his chair and a chip on his shoulder, and, is very antagonistic. You have to be careful if you're going to work with anybody that has that type of, demeanor. Especially if you've got a situation where you don't know how to get from point A to point B yet. So if you're going to work with somebody, and there are times where I heartily, heartily recommend that you, do invite help in, because somebody to apply your character, sit down and say, and just ask them, how do we state this so I can get this relief? You know, and remember, that attorney works for you. You don't work for them. When you put together, you know, and when he puts together a pleading, you just ask him, where's the summary in the first paragraph or two that states the claim for which, the relief that I need, and explain to me how that works. Ask them that. I don't expect less than 1 in 5 of us have any, chance with the small background that we have of doing any good for ourselves or somebody else in court by ourselves. The other 4 out of 5 of us, we all need help. There are a few Lone Rangers out there, and I'm proud when I get a chance to meet one of them, that especially if it's a student that wants to be the Lone Ranger and actually successfully does it and learns it down cold. And they, we've had a few students graduate recently that, Michael and I are just unbelievably proud of, that they took their schooling, and some of them didn't. And we've talked about a couple of them, and some of them never made it to the arraignment, never made it to court. And, you know, the students, they did their jurisprudence, and the definition of jurisprudence is the hobby or study of law. And they did it right. They, made a claim for which relief could be granted. And then they ABC'd very explicitly, without getting wordy or complicated, they very explicitly explained how and why the law applied or didn't apply, and so that the justice and the in some of those cases, there were criminal prosecutions involved. In one case, the prosecutor sent a very nice motion to dismiss multiple grand jury indictments. You know, and actually we've had a couple of those, you know, there's one of the ones in the last couple of months that have graduated that is the prosecutor himself dismissed it. The just because you need relief doesn't mean you should go ahead and run off and file a petition in a court. You need to know what relief you want or need and what you're willing to accept and be compensated for in advance. Don't just go into there with a temper because you've been despoiled or damaged or injured. Know in advance and decide, especially those of you who are married, talk with your spouse and reconcile what you're willing to accept. Put that in writing, put that in the pleading, and then move forward. With that, I've run over a minute already on my time. We're going to open it up for question and answer. You're not required to stay with the subject matter topic. We're honored if you do. It's always a good thing to exhaust topics and share, find out what each other has to share. But thank you very much. With that, back to you, Martin.
All right. Now, Brother John, I just wanted to clarify here because one of the last things you were talking about, you mentioned help. I want to make sure, is this really for everybody? You know, like for myself, for example, my mother always said that there was no help for me.
Oh, yeah. Don't feel bad. Talk about a blow to your typical macho American male ego. Half my friends tell me I need help and the other half tell me I'm beyond help. I mean, what's a poor guy to do, right?
All right, folks.
Are you sure that wasn't your father that said that?
Well, nothing I'll admit to in public, you know.
Before you do your thing, Martin, I want to share something with everyone here that I don't know if you picked up on it. The greatest intrepidation that I hear from potential students to be is, I can't do this. I have to hire an attorney. Can't you go into court for me? The way the program works in a student-teacher relationship is the same way that you eat an elephant, one bite at a time. There's a general overview that you're discussed with, and before we go further, John can clearly understand, the team can clearly understand, you understand what you're doing at this point, as far as the 30,000 foot view might be. And people with, and I'm just saying this as a fact, not in anything else other than a fact, people with little education, people who trust in the plan, and believe me, you're going to learn that part of that plan includes the creator of the universe, whether you believe in him or not. Trust in the plan, and every hearing that you're going to prepare for is limited in scope to just that part of the hearing. It's just that part. And the team drills you and works with you, assists you with written educational material, teaching syllabus, if you would, that some students have come back and says, well, I don't understand this part of it. So it's explained and it's discussed further until they understand everything that they're getting ready to consider filing. And not only are they looking at what has been presented to them as a teaching syllabus, but they're encouraged to look around the internet for other things as well. And we have a few students that bring John, bring the team material And sometimes it's, hey, that's awesome. Good find. And so forth. So what I want you to understand is that no matter how difficult your problem is, it can be, you can learn how to operate within it and through it on your own with the help of your teachers. And there's one more thing I want you to understand very, very clearly. When you hire an attorney, when you become a client who applies to a lawyer or a counselor for advice and direction in a question of law, or you commit to his or her management in prosecuting a claim or defending against a suit in a court of justice, one who retains the attorney is responsible to him for his fees, and to whom the attorney is responsible for the management of the suit. One who communicates facts to an attorney expecting professional advice. Clients are often called and also called wards of the court in regard to their relationship to their attorneys. When you hire an attorney, you become a ward of the court. Do you understand the ramifications of that? Look up the word ward of court in a law dictionary, words and phrases. It's defined as infants and persons of unsound mind placed by the court under the care of a guardian. Davis's Committee versus Looney, 290 Kentucky, 644, 162 Southwest 2nd. Their rights must be guarded jealously. Are you an infant? Are you a person of an unsound mind? You are when you hire an attorney. Do you need a jurisdiction? Do you need to challenge jurisdiction? In propria persona, it's one's own proper person. It was formerly a rule of pleading that pleas to the jurisdiction of the court must be pled in propria persona, because if pled by an attorney, they admit to jurisdiction. Once you've corrected your status, you're even elevated to another standing, and that standing is called sui juris, standing in your own right. So, as an attorney, as an officer of the court, the attorney is presumed to plead after having obtained leave and admits to the jurisdiction. So when you hire an attorney, you become a ward of the court and a second-class citizen. You admit to the jurisdiction of the court in the matter of hand. You cannot hire an attorney if you want to challenge jurisdiction. If you want to challenge jurisdiction, the only way you can do it is sui juris or in propria persona. So should you hire an attorney? Absolutely not. I wouldn't. Never would. Back to you, John and Martin.
Well, real quick, Mr. Edward, wrap it up on that same topic, just to clarify, because I'm sure there's a couple in the audience that would be confused as I was the first time. You've got to put a space between the A and the W for a ward. You don't want to get our ward and think that you've won something. I'm on a roll tonight. Star 2 on your keypad, folks, if you have a question. Star 2 to raise your hand. If you're on the Freedoms Radio side listening, type your question in the question bar or your comment. But please don't forget to click submit. If you don't click the submit button, it won't show up on our side. We'll see you there. Ed in Pennsylvania. Go ahead, sir. You've been unmuted.
Looking for my mute button. I don't know about eating elephants. I eat enough crow, though. I have a friend, since I'm going to bring him up, because I plan on going the trust route. And, of course, after I have the correction of my status and going after the passport, and then I'll have... keep moving ahead, and I'll establish the trusts and corporation sole. We'll go from there. Now, I have a good example in a history museum that I'm familiar with. It's an industrial arts museum, And we have a fellow there who's come on in the last 3 years who's funding everything. And he bought some land that was just all screwed up land. And I encouraged him through a closer friend of mine to put it all into a trust. And I explained how what he wants to do is return it back to uncivilized raw land with trees growing on it that were there before white people came here, Western Europeans came here. And he's Roman Catholic, and I'd have thought that there's a lot of corporation souls within the Roman Catholic, within Roman Catholicism. I'd have thought he knew about it, but he didn't. So I've mentioned again through my friend, I don't know why the reticence to introduce me to him, but I encouraged him to go with a religious trust, and I gathered that he did, but the local people, I don't know whether it's the county tax assessor or whether it's another officer of the county, they refused to give him his exception on property taxes. And I'm going to go this same route. And I don't, now he is an attorney. And I don't know, well, I can imagine that makes his, obviously his status is different than mine. But I'm wondering if the proper route for me to consider, and John, you're working on this from a perspective that I really like. You know, like, everyone should have their land and should not be paying taxes on it because it's, you need that to live. You need land to live on. And then but once we have a trust, I don't know whether I would be allowed to defend my trust, to defend the trust that I'm in. From everything I've read in the past, trusts all need to be defended by an attorney. I don't know what works around that. That end of things might be a better question to ask Bernie, I'm not sure. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah. That's a good question. I'm assuming you want an answer on that.
You assume correctly.
Or
tell me if you're working on it.
You've got a couple of issues there. One of them is that you're dealing with a non-statute religious trust. You understand
right.
What that term, you know, a non-statute, you know, you understand what a non-statute religious trust is, right?
Exactly.
The key operative word being non-statute, because if you're dealing with a statute trust, we just used the word statute. Where do the statutes come from? They're usually a fundamental act of some legislator somewhere, correct? A statute.
Correct.
So the statute that generates a trust, you must comply with the related definition and terms of that statute or that statutory trust, okay? Now, if you're not using a statutory trust, then the statutes don't apply. There is a common misconception and misperception that's very, very simple. They just use the word trust. I know what I'm talking about with a trust. I went to law school. And they fall back on their education and everything they learned. And the statutes require that that a statutory trust be represented by an attorney. A non-statutory religious trust can be represented by the trustee. Or in certain cases, the Article 6 council, what happens is that you need to very tactfully and pleasantly make them aware that this is a non-statutory religious trust. And once they see the fact that it's a non-statutory religious trust, and Justice Beshears is extremely eloquent at making that definition. In fact, I had a call, I had a situation, last week, we invited Justice Beshears, and he makes himself very plainly available for these type of calls. And we had somebody that a title company that was saying, "Well, this trust, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, this is all wrong. This is, you know, not per the law." And I was thinking to myself, and all I could think of was, "You are so correct. It's not per the law."
Yeah.
And I had a discussion with a judge a while back where the judge says, "Sorry, this is not the way a trust operates." And I says, "Your Honor," I says, "don't worry, it's much worse than you think. If this was a statutory trust, I would have to agree with you 100%. And she said, "What do you mean, if?" I says, and a lot of times the moment you bring up the word trust and you're a trustee, that shuts down the, especially if you're on a Zoom, hearing, they almost won't let you speak. Since the CB19 thing. And so we've been having trouble getting past that. It hasn't been that easy. I've got one case where the judge, we're preparing to file criminal charges, deprivation of civil rights under color of law, because she's kind of elderly. She's an old dog. You're not a buck. And no young buck under the age of 70 is going to teach her a new trick, you know. And it's literally almost that bad, literally. It's and so what happens is that right now, and her situation is exclusively a time permitting situation for me. I've been so busy that I just haven't, the only reason she has not been prosecuted yet is because I haven't had the time to prosecute her, or to seek prosecution against her. And so, but the moment my, dance card thing clears up a little bit, we're going to invite her to a discussion to before a bench, a separate bench, to discuss her performance. And the thing is that you have a non-statutory religious trust, so you have to remember that you have, when you're dealing with that with the court, be tactful and pleasant. Just remind them, Your Honor, thank you. You know, if he says, "I'm sorry, you have to have an attorney." "Oh, thank you for pointing that out, Your Honor. And had this been a statutory religious trust, I would have to agree with you 100%. I mean, or had this been a statutory trust, I would agree with you 100%. However, at this juncture, because this is a non-statutory religious trust, at this time, I would like to object to your observation there." And you have to be tactful about it. Don't want to antagonize them, but that's what's happening.
Good.
Does that make sense?
It
But now, does that would still take it out of, make me arguing against the tax assessor just as an American national. Because I'd still be an American national, but I'd be the trustee of a religious trust at that point. Correct?
Yeah.
Of course, we're out of regulatory bounds anyways, as American nationals.
Okay. Now you got to be careful about the way you propose that. All of us are bound by law. All of us are bound, and the simplest and quickest and easiest way to prove that is just that we're all bound by God's law. Now, there are the only things that an American national is not bound by is corporate law, and that includes the corporation that's doing business for the aggregate United States of America. And the laws that they subjectively apply to us, we need to be very careful that we recognize that some of it comes from the aggregate, and we have a responsibility for the aggregate Constitution. Now, the Constitution that was duplicated for the corporation mirrors are almost identical to the original Constitution. There was a good reason they did it that way, but nonetheless, we have to remember that there has to be some rules of order, whether it's Roberts or constitutional or however you want to put it. There's a And we have to recognize that in this case common law is what's critical, that's very, very important. And that's that to have a crime, for the most part in common law, to have a crime, you have to have a injured party with justiciable standing that's willing to file a verified complaint. And it breaks down to that old saying about what were the two laws, or the second of the two laws, that when Yeshua was questioned, he says, what's the most important law? The first one was, what did he say? Love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your might. And what was the second one?
Love your neighbor as yourself.
Yep. And that's common law right there.
Yes.
And that is, so remember, maybe 70 miles an hour down that stretch of Interstate Highway 10 that's posted for 55, maybe because it's 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning, it's got good light and it's perfectly safe, and you can see for 10 miles or 15 miles, there's no problem. The statute law says but there's a statute that says you're breaking the law. Well, unless at 70 miles an hour you create a hazard for somebody, or even cause somebody to live fearfully about crossing their street because you're going too fast, just doing 25 in a 25. See, under common law, something is maybe supposed to 25 and you're doing 24, but the pedestrians. Traffic there says it should be 10 or 15. Now under common law, you are breaking the law. You know, you're imposing on individuals. They're feeling threatened with their life because of the unsafe condition that they feel you're presenting. So, just try to be thoughtful about the fact that, we're all responsible to the Most High King, and, He who lives within the law has no fear of it. Have I gone a couple of miles over the speed limit before? Yeah. have I got invited to discussions about my performance? Yeah. The last time I think that I got one on my record was close to 50 years ago. That's not definitely not the last time I drove in excess of the speed limit. It,
I hear you.
Please,
more time.
Yeah. Okay. Continuing on, my honored brother, do you have any other questions?
No, that was it for now.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome, sir.
All right. Now we've got, yes, sir. Now we've got Don in Iowa. Go ahead, Don.
Yeah, thank you. Great, great information tonight. We change our status, and I've known for a long time who I am. I'm a creation of God the Father, creator of the universe. So why is it we have to change that status and all the court filings have to be in the all capital letter fiction? I guess I have a problem with that. Is there any way possible we can go in as a living being?
You pointed out the fact that we were changing your status. Now, actually, you used the word change. May I humbly submit a correction or an improvement for that?
Please.
Okay. It's you're correcting your status. And what happens is that some individuals that would desire to control you and all that you are felt in their magnanimous consideration the fact that they would like to enumerate you and have you and all of your assets included as part and parcel to the collateral that they have set up to the World Bank and back then the IMF also. The Federal Reserve. At this juncture, if you, they've given you a specific status as a piece of collateral, for their purposes. Okay. Now, if you, with the State Department, who is responsible for keeping, that information and guarding it, if you identify that you're not a piece of collateral property but a living, breathing human being, and you have the data updated in their computer, you haven't changed anything. You've actually just corrected the way they treat you and the way they look at you. So humbly and respectfully, you are still you. Nothing has changed. You're not somebody else now. You're still the same person, and part and parcel, you're still the same living, breathing human being that you were hours or days ago. But what happens is that now they just don't. We've got the records in the computer corrected. Okay, so you're not changing anything. You're correcting their perception of what has always been reality. Does that make sense?
Yes, I've noticed on my birth certificate I was born, and it's my opinion I had God-given unalienable rights for approximately 2 weeks. And then I was registered, and I'm old enough to where it's got the Department of Commerce numbers on it. I realized I was pledged as a chattel for the national debt. Then there's no problem. There's no problem religiously or anything else going in there and filing that court case in all capital letters. I guess that's the only way we can do it, right?
Now, please explain what you mean by the court case in all capital letters. define that for all of it, for especially for those that are listening that don't know what we're talking about.
Well, in the past, I have known years ago that I'm a living, breathing being, and I thought I sign my name in upper and lower case, and that's a living being, and yet they want everything, or they want everything in all capital letters to indicate a person.
So you still you know what's the difference between all caps and versus upper and lower? What's the difference?
Well, the all caps is a corporation, a trust, or anything else. A person can be is anything but a living being. And so
an
all capital letter.
An all caps is an artificial entity, correct?
In my understanding, yes.
Okay. Yeah. Then, if that's your understanding, then you're correct. All caps is an artificial entity or something created by the state or the government. Okay.
Yes.
So, when you submit your filings, are you an artificial entity or are you a living, breathing human being?
Well, I always believed I was a living human being and submitted them as such.
Hey. Well, there you go. So
why
I guess you
it,
are
I
a living. Now, who told you you had to be all caps? Somebody told you that. Because I can hear it in your voice that you don't believe them. Who's telling you that?
I guess that's a presumption that the court has, and it's our job to break that presumption, which I think I have in the last 10 years. It's on the record, and there's never been a response, so they agree with me. but I hadn't corrected that status. I still don't have the passport. I'm working on that. But I had given them notice, registered mail, da 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 da. And they didn't recognize my status, even though I knew who I was and maintained that. And for them to come back and say otherwise is a federal violation called personage. So
okay.
I guess.
If I was to ask you, what's holding you, may I ask you, what's holding you from getting your passport?
I had to get some information on my mother, my mother and father's birthday. And I had to go out and see my brother today to get that. But no, I'm working on it. Hopefully I'll have that done within a week.
So we are sneaking up on it.
Yeah. I realize it. But okay, I go through that. And basically, I have had the affidavit. It's been on the public record. It's been running the newspaper for 3 weeks, so I have an agreement. They can't back out of knowing who I am, but still it doesn't answer the question. Are you saying I can file a action by using upper and lower case?
Yes, absolutely. Without equivocation.
Well, I've done that for 20 years, but I guess I haven't broken their presumption and had the right documentation on their computers yet.
Comment?
Yeah.
Comment?
Yes, please, Michael.
There's defensive litigation and there's offensive litigation. Deprivation of rights on the color of law is going on the offense. And two of the team students presently, there is one student who both the arresting officer, the charging officer, and the prosecutor are going to soon be facing a federal lawsuit. In another one, it's only the arresting officer because the prosecutor and the attorneys and the judge, the prosecutor dropped the charges. You're knowledgeable in many things, John, but you have not developed the knowledge base on how to go on the offensive. Someone said you don't win a game by defense. You've got to go on the offense. John, do you want to cover that?
Some of the students that he's talking about, we spent a couple hours on the phone with one of them today, even. If you know the truth, you probably remember that old saying, you should know the truth and the truth shall set you free. Well, in this situation, what's happening is that, some of the students, once they realized what the truth was, one of them got so angry, and I heard his voice change. The inflections on his voice changed significantly, and I was going to ask the lady with him, I was on the phone, is it okay for his blood pressure? I was almost tempted to ask that because you could hear he was so angry when he realized the truth, and next thing we know, and we may have had a teeny bit of a guided discussion there, but next thing we know, the next letter that went to the court or the motion to dismiss before he was even arraigned, he stated those things so emphatically that, and somehow that got into the court record without all the extra emotion that he was demonstrating on the phone. With this one student, we're going to see if we can get an appointment to chat with the prosecutor tomorrow or Thursday. And he has multiple grand jury indictments, multiple felony grand jury indictments, this student. And we're going to see if we can get with the prosecutor, either tomorrow or Thursday or no later than Friday. And he hasn't been arraigned yet. But we're going to see if we can educate the prosecutor. And this is the way we take the offensive, by knowledge are our weapons, and knowledge is power. And if we can educate the other side so they realize so that they all of a sudden scratch their head and go, wait a minute, we shouldn't be prosecuting this. This is wrong. Whether it's the judge or the state or federal prosecutor or whoever, but if they scratch their head and say, wait a minute, this guy's right. We shouldn't be prosecuting him. I'm going to move to dismiss. You know, and we've had the honor and privilege of maybe seeing that once or twice or many times. And so many times that I've learned that trying to take care of these, especially criminal cases, before they even come up for arraignment, that's the best way to handle it. And so what Michael's suggesting is that it's very, they say the best defense is good offense. Well, that's what we're doing. We're proactively educating them with our weapons. And that's, you ever heard somebody say your remedy is in the law? I don't know. I don't hear it very often. Maybe you have heard it somewhere. But your remedy is in the law. And believe it or not, even though some of the laws are null and void, that's Marbury versus Madison, 1803, Second Cranch, 179, you know. And I regularly include that into, you know, the students' teaching, and they enjoy putting it into their brief and supportive motion for dismissal, you know. And so we use our weapons, and there's an old saying, and this comes, and the best I know, it comes from an event in South, the one I know comes from an event in Southeast Asia where this sergeant was getting ready to take an armful of his soldiers, and they were going to go rush the VC and with against implacable odds over 7-1. And this young lieutenant says, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, stop. What are you doing?" He says, Don't try to stop us. I'm ready to give my life for my country. We're going to go beat these guys even if it costs us our lives." He says, paraphrase, "Chill out, pelican breath, pilgrim. Let the other guy sacrifice his life for what he believes, not you." And some of these people, we want to let them sacrifice their life for what they believe. And by educating them properly and us getting a good education and bringing that to prosecution, those individuals, and I don't mean being dead, I mean in court with a life sentence for what they've done wrong, depriving the civil rights of individuals under color of law to the place where that first somebody even got dead or was in prison wrongfully, that having coming to the place where we create a new order that every prosecutor and every judge out there is scared in his boots to walk into the courtroom because they know there's an armload of judges and prosecutors that are already in prison for screwing up, and then a man making God in his own image. You know, we're going to make them give their life for what they believe, and they're going to spend it. Too bad they can't spend it on a rock farm, but we're going to make sure that they don't do it in some minimum security prison like Danbury.
Oh, that's great news. I guess I have to be humble to admit I probably made a lot of mistakes. I probably was too aggressive. I knew I had the right to travel 20 years ago, and let's say they knew I knew the right and I had the law to beat them and the right to travel, but I wasn't smart enough to realize that the driver's licensing, if I wanted, set a precedent to destroy a $1 billion business. So I've learned. I've taken a 10-year sabbatical and just kept learning. I want to ask you one quick question. At one time on the land, I had the land patents and everything else, and I was in the case. I tried to remove the case from the local district court to the federal court, and I always knew that I lived without the United States. And I signed everything under penalty of perjury under the laws of the United States of America, proving I was without the United States. And that federal judge, he came back and he ruled against me. He said, "I don't belong in the limited jurisdiction of a U.S. federal court." And then he reemphasized that and highlighted it. Even though I could refile, I could see no reason to do so. And I was ticked at the time, but when I thought about it, I think that judge told me that he knew I was without the United States and basically directed my nationality to his satisfaction. What do you think?
I think you're right. I think you're right. I think you're correct.
Well, I went out and got a certified copy, and I carried it in my wallet for a long, long time because I thought, I thought that I can't get my friends to agree with that. They said, "Nah, nah, nah, nah." But I think just because I showed him and everything I signed that I was without the United States. That was proof to him that I didn't belong in that court. Now, what would be the right court to where I should go? What is the right court? It's definitely not the federal district court, is it?
No, there's it's called a common law court, and presently there's there was a common law court in the Dallas-Fort Worth area of Texas for a while. There's been a handful of these situations where common law courts right now are hard to find. And I say hard to find because and technically all courts are supposed to be common law courts, technically. And I actually had a statute, an admiralty court, you know, and you could tell it's an admiralty court because it's got the gold fringe on the flag behind the judge. But what happened was is that I asked a few tactful questions. I says, you know, and I asked about constitutional questions, and I says, and the judge says, well, that doesn't apply here. I says, I'm sorry, sir, but technically you're inside of the limits of the boundaries, meets and bounds of the United States. And I did use that term, and I don't like using that term, but I did there. And I says, are you saying the Constitution doesn't apply here? And he looked at me. He says, why do you ask that question? I says, well, you know, for the obvious reason. I says, because your authority is derived under Section 3 of the Constitution, or Article 3 of the Constitution. And if the Constitution doesn't apply, then you don't have any authority, and that means I'm leaving. And if that bailiff attempts to stop me because he doesn't have the authority to, if he even lays a hand on me, that's assault. And that means this federal marshal here is going to shoot him. And then because he's going to try to put you under arrest. And if you resist arrest, that he has the right, not just the right, but the responsibility to shoot you also. And I was young and I was cocky and I was out of control. I was 27 years old at the time, and I had a bad tack on my chair, and I was very upset with this justice in Southern California. And he says, you little, I says, excuse me, sir, but right now I really do need an answer for that question. And he says, you know, and when he realized that I did have a federal marshal with me, he says, okay, so what do you expect of me? I says, well, technically statute law doesn't apply here. It has to be common law. He goes, what do you know about common law? I says, well, I says, you know, Professor Phillips, you spoke in his class. And he says, that I did. Okay. And all of a sudden he says, I declare this to be a common law court with a common law hearing today. And, wow. That was in 1984. I was young, I was cocky, I was out of control, and I was so upset that I was about to get myself detained for contempt of court, and somehow the judge didn't detain me for contempt of court. But I have seen the situation where I know it is possible. So there you are. Realistically, we do need to be in common law court.
Okay. Erie Railroad versus Tompkins in 38 states there's no such thing as federal common law. And yet in the state of Illinois.
Okay. Federal. You just used the word federal. Why'd you use that word?
Well, that's in your federal district course, or the United States. Within the United States, apparently, the corporation, there's no common law. And yet in Iowa, there's been an opinion to the Iowa Supreme Court, and he opined that even though our Constitution doesn't recognize the common law has always been in effect in Iowa. And I think he's talking about Iowa State, but everything is state of Iowa. So probably the common law does not apply within the state of Iowa, but it probably does within Iowa State.
The moment you say the word federal, you're talking about statute law, because you're saying corporation. The moment you say federal, okay?
Yeah, you're correct.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And it makes sense with the Admiralty flag, because in 1951, and this is how convoluted it is, in 1951 they came out with the Admiralty Extension Act, and it was meant to extend the water line into the docks so that the dock workers could get insurance, but they convoluted it to make the high water mark and extended admirably to the inland, to the highest mountain.
Yeah.
It's so convoluted. They do everything without our knowledge. You have to really dig to find it, but it's there. I mean, they bring the water line to the highest mountain so that they can stay, so they can bring Admiralty all throughout the country.
Right. Respectfully and regrettably, you are painfully accurate.
Well, you're accurate too. I mean, the first responsibility of an attorney is to the court, not the client. Corpus Juris Secundum, Book 7A. Under attorney-client privileges, so you cannot ever hire an attorney, because you're going to get screwed. The judge controls his bar card.
Yeah.
Am I correct on that?
You're very correct.
And see, in my case, I 20 years ago, I knew how to beat them on the right to travel, and so they threw me in the psych ward, drugged me, and I lost 12 years of my life by being a zombie. And so I've been very careful to stay out of court, and I since learned, I was like you, and I kind of was a little aggressive, and I read, it saved me. A magistrate can throw you in contempt for 30 days and a district judge for 6 months. So it slowed me down.
Yeah. Well, though a man seeks an audience with the king, it's from God that he gets justice. Never forget that. Okay? All of us, no matter how it slices out, the only one that truly gives us justice is the Most High, is the one who is on Most High, Yahweh. And it says, the heart of the king is in the hand of the Lord. He directs it wherever which he pleases, like a water course. Never forget that.
Yeah, I've forgotten that. I've read through the good book twice, and thank you for refreshing my memory. That's good knowledge.
Yeah, well, there's one. I'll leave you with one other one then also. When all a man's ways please the Lord, he causes even his enemies to live at peace with him.
Amen. Don't I wish the whole world could live in peace? I think everybody wants to live in peace, and there's too much strife. For the love of God.
When I find myself feeling overrun and overwrought, I ask myself if my ways are pleasing the Most High King.
That's a good way to look on it. At it. I mean, I haven't had a TV for 25 years, so I try to get my knowledge through alternative sources and on the phone. And let's just say years ago, I saw the wind blew the TV antenna, and on channel 4 WHBF, it was snowy, and I saw two lines go across the top of the screen, then down in the middle, and then down at the bottom. So I knew 25 years ago they were using subliminal images, and I've since rented all the new TVs and computers with the flickering. They basically memorize us in 30 seconds. So it's mind control.
All right.
Listen, in November.
We've got the 11 o'clock coming up here on the East Coast, 2 hours since the call started, and we have three more people waiting in line to talk to John. I just want to point that out. I'm not trying to cut John off.
Thank you.
I will say I agree with you about the TV. November of 1977, I took the TV out. I had five people living with me at the time in my condominium. We took the dumpster, turned outside, put the TV in there, and took a pellet gun and shot its brains out and tipped the dumpster back up on its, you know. And five of those people living with me, three of those five were early released from Chino Men's Institution in Southern California. I was an off-book early release program I was running for, but I haven't had a TV antenna, satellite, cable, or dish hooked up since November of 1977, so I agree with you. But with that, are we good to move on to the next student?
Oh, yeah, I yield. Thank you very much. Sorry to take up the time of the other question. Sorry about that.
That's quite all right. It's our honor and privilege to serve you. We seek Michael, Martin, and myself, and all, you'll find that all your information providers seek to serve the Most High King by serving our fellow person. And some people talk about their great work for God, but this is how we're carrying out our service to the Most High King. He said, whatever you've done unto least these little ones, you've done unto me. Hey, Martin or Michael, you want to bring on the next one?
Yep, thank you so much. I'm sorry, did I hear Mr. Edward cut in? No. All right, Ron in Florida, go ahead.
Yes, maximum of law, paper to paper, person to person. You cannot do business person to paper or paper to person. Correct?
You the man. All right. Go ahead. You've got another point to make here. I smell smoke.
Well, that's what I've got on that particular topic. My next topic is you were discussing the doctors and that they are now required to see a patient every 90 days.
When the FDA now requires doctors for certain dispensing of certain prescriptions now that now account for over a quarter of the pharmaceuticals that can be prescribed are required to see their patients. If their patients are being prescribed, any one of that group, which is almost a quarter of the prescribed pharmaceuticals, they're required to see them minimum once every 90 days now.
Now, you blew my theory. I am involved with the VA, and my primary doctor wants to see me every 7 months. I think that's a little ridiculous.
Okay.
But
okay, you're at the VA?
Yes.
Okay, but what branch did you serve in?
Air Force, 5 years.
When did you get out?
70.
Thank you for your service. I got out in 76. But thank you for your service. The VA is under different guidelines. They're not required to adhere to that 90-day rule. And actually, it's not a rule. It's a It's a memorandum of policy.
Okay. Yeah, my VA doctor and I are having a conflict of interest, but that's a personal problem.
You mean he wants to treat the symptoms and you want him to treat the problem?
No, he doesn't. She doesn't want to treat at all. She just wants me to come in, say hi, goodbye, and die.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, we had a heart-to-heart about 3-4 months ago, and she's changed her attitude greatly since I went through protocol, and I think she got called up on the carpet. I had food poisoning and COVID at the same time. Was heaving up my socks for about 6 weeks, actually, altogether. And I had been complaining about other symptoms, and she just, you know, said, yeah, fine, okay, bye, die. She changed her attitude after I got out of the hospital. But anyway, I'll leave my rant at that.
I thank you for your service, my honored brother. Appreciate you very much. Thank you. Back to you, Martin. Who's next?
All right. And again, star 2 keypad. Star 2 on your keypad, folks. If you have a question, star 2. If you're on the Freedoms Radio side, type your question or comment in the question bar. And don't forget to click submit. Next up, we've got Jennifer in New York. Go ahead, Jennifer.
Hi.
Lovely Jennifer. How are you, girl?
I'm pretty good, thank you. I just
pretty good?
Okay, I'm bloody great.
Ah, sick 'em doggy. You go, girl. You rock. Okay, here's Jennifer.
My husband was, he got an attorney multiple years ago. And I just wanted to comment about for 5 years he did nothing, didn't know anything about the case or anything. So my husband decided not to use him anymore, basically to fire him and say, I'm going to do it myself. And he wasn't allowed to not use that attorney. And so he had to go to some hearing where they could determine whether he was allowed to fire this attorney. Anyway, he ended up firing him and doing it himself. And I just thought it was pretty weird that you can't fire your own, you know, an attorney that has done nothing for you except take your money.
Yeah, there was a, you know, Jennifer, I heard a, I'll use the term, I heard a recent story about something the same way, where a judge in Ohio told, well, I shouldn't even mention the state, but there may have been a judge that said, I'm sorry, but you can't represent yourself, I'm going to appoint a standby counsel. And this gentleman became so enraged, he says, you're in contempt of the Constitution. I, under the Sixth Amendment, I have the right to choose whoever I please. You do not. That's way above your pay grade. And the judge says, I can find you in contempt. He says, you'll go to jail before you find me in contempt. And,
mm-hmm.
And this guy was so upset that shocked this judge and says, I choose my own counsel, not you. And
right.
he got very, very upset with him. And, the judge ended up letting him do what he wanted to. It was kind of shocking because this judge has never, ever done that. I talked to the judge's clerk in 22 years. This judge has never allowed anybody with a felony criminal indictment against them to represent themselves.
Hmm. Well, I guess they won their battle, and then they went to court, him and another guy who were working together, and even though they didn't win, I felt like the judge couldn't let someone without an attorney win. But all they did was say, "Well, you got to pay a few bucks," which it was never enforced anyway, because the person making the claim was just an stupid person and had no claim in reality. But anyway, I just thought I'd pop in with that I just couldn't believe that you can't even fire your own attorney, according to them.
Yeah, that's what this gentleman did in court, and the judge says you can't do that, and he got so upset. I actually read the transcripts from the hearing, and the court reporter bleeped out a few of the words.
Well, but he wasn't in court at the time. He was just asking. It was like 5 years, and we hadn't heard anything, and so he called the attorney, and he didn't even know anything about the case, and, you know, wanted more money to keep going. And when we said, you know, when they said, "No, we're not paying you another dime, you haven't even done anything with the money we gave you the first time," that's when they had to go to some special hearing that allowed them, that they would decide whether he could fire the judge, the attorney, or not. And they were allowed to. Of course, if I knew what I knew now, things would have been different. But back then, I wasn't involved anyway, so I wasn't in the hearing or anything.
3 years ago, this gentleman, in the face of horrible adversity from the bench, came up with the most eloquent words that I've come to date. He was only a student for about 4.5 months. I came on his case after he had been arraigned. Somebody asked me for help with this gentleman, and the gentleman says, "Your Honor, Constitution Article 3 that establishes your authority also establishes Article 6 that, the Sixth Amendment that establishes my right to choose my counsel. So please, I need you to make a decision." And the judge says, "About what?" "If the Constitution stands, then you have the right to hear this case, and I have the right to choose my own counsel. And if the Constitution doesn't stand, and I don't have the right to choose my own counsel, then you don't have the right to hear this case."
Mm. Right. Good one.
And that's probably as eloquent as I've ever heard it put.
Right.
The judge backed down, and he allowed the gentleman to terminate his attorney, right? And, by the way, it was a jury trial, and they were in the middle of the trial when he did that.
Great.
The jury actually, exonerated him. Go ahead.
I'll let the next person, you know, ask their question. I just wanted to say that. That's all.
Thank you. Thank you, Jennifer. The Father's blessings be upon you. You have a wonderful evening, girl. And now, back to you, Martin.
All right. Thank you so much. You get a refresh here on the Freedoms Radio side. Actually, while we're waiting on that, Kent in West Virginia. Go ahead, sir.
Yes. Good evening, gentlemen. Can you hear me all right?
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Okay, John. Thank you for your talk tonight. I appreciate it, and thank you for some of the details that you provide. I want to mention one thing and then clarify one thing and then ask you four questions regarding definitions, one or two of which came up for question on last night's call, and we said we should refer it to you. So the first thing, as far as you were talking about laws that apply to nationals. I'm glad you clarified that, because I was just having a conversation with a former New York City detective recently who now heads security for a New York City facility, and he was telling me that more and more people are coming in there claiming to be sovereigns and basically spouting off about their rights. He said, now, you come in here much differently and speak about it in a very intelligent manner, and he said, I can have a conversation with you, or my people can have a conversation with you. So I think the point that you make is very valid, that we should not get carried away just because we get some identification or because we're able to articulate who we are. We should not get so carried away with this that we feel like no laws apply and that society could just be, you know, a mass of anybody doing what they want to do at any time. I think that we do need some quote-unquote law and order, and if we're operating with other people, that we should respect them also. So I think that you make a very valid point, and I'm glad the gentleman brought that up about what laws apply to American nationals. Is there anything you want to add to that before I go on to the next item?
That's, you know, when we're young, and I don't mean calendar age. I mean young with respect to our fellow person and the community. We, each one of us seeks our own identity and our own person and our place in life. And to those of us who haven't found it yet, sometimes, rather than letting people give us respect because we're worthy and have worked for it and earned it and deserve it, we take it. And some of us have been chopped down so far that, and I met somebody just this last week who, you know, we were talking and I says, you know, you've got a horrible anger that goes way back. This is not something that happened recently. And I asked him to please look me in the eyes. I says, it looks like something goes back even to your childhood, maybe even your parents that, mistreated you and didn't, they stole your respect and your considerate personal self-esteem from you. And he admitted that it had been his mother. And, but what happened, he says, how did you know that? I says, well, you're taking respect rather than letting people give it to you. And he was so shocked. You know, and in the short week and a half since that happened, his personal countenance has changed drastically. Today, I saw that gentleman and he shook my hand. He says, I never knew that I was doing that to people. You know, and a lot of people that, and it's more young people than is, young people calendar age that, they want respect. They want people to respect them. They want to be, they're searching for their significance. And to that end, yes, I'm a sovereign and you have to respect me. You know, and it's something that they glom onto and they latch onto and they hang onto. But the issue isn't the sovereignty. It's the fact that their significance and their self-respect, is almost non-existent. And you ever see somebody that, doesn't love themselves? They can't love anybody else. Somebody that can't forgive themselves doesn't have forgiveness, so they don't have any for anybody else. Somebody who doesn't have self-esteem for themselves doesn't have it for anybody else. If they don't have it for themselves, how can they have any for anybody else? And so what happens is a lot of these people that are, you know, they're shaking their fist at God, or the mouse with the grass, great act of defiance is giving that eagle with talons perched the international sign for love, peace, and joy as it swoops on him. You know, they respect, love, self-esteem. People are like glass, a drinking glass. You put a little bit in there and they have some. You know, you keep giving it to them, and for good, legitimate reasons, and eventually it fills up the glass. But if you keep giving it to them, eventually it overflows on them around them and they start to give it out. So when you see people like that that are kind of almost all but shaking their fist at God, saying, I'm a sovereign, you know, and I've seen so many of them. And I was at a conference in the Lesser Antilles one time where it was exclusively a sovereign's convention. A lot of these people that one girl had 92 passports legitimately from 92 countries, and she was a legitimate sovereign, and she had a tack on her chair and a chip on her shoulder. And it wasn't until 3 years later at the same conference, three years later, that we had a chance to, my wife and I had a chance to have dinner with her, you know, and she wrote us a letter 2 years later saying, you know, it's strange. I don't have a need for all these passports anymore. You changed my life. All we did was have dinner with her once. You may be able to help some of these people that are giving people that genuinely have some level of sovereignty. And I absolutely do not like to use that word because it's become almost a note of disdain, especially in judges' ears. You know, and so if we're careful and we give respect legitimately, you know, not blowing smoke up somebody's tailcone, you know, that jet engine, you know, but being honest and respectful, giving respect. It's amazing how we can take these people that are almost like a junkyard dog barking, give them some peace, and then they can pass it on to their fellow person. And then they truly are sovereign before the Most High King.
If I may add something or interject something here, if you go to Westlaw Dictionary 4th, 5th, and 6th edition and look up United States, the first definition is the name of a sovereign occupying the position analogous to other sovereigns in the nations of the world. When King George III, at the Treaty of Peace, referred to his former enemy combatants, his former colonists, as his peer, from which we get the castle doctrine that we enjoy today, by birthright, there are many, many, many Americans who are actually sovereign.
Right. Okay. Thank you, Michael. Okay, please continue.
My grandfather, Nathaniel, 8 times removed, was listed in the Massachusetts Militia Registry from 1770, late 1760, 1770, all the way through and past 1812, where he continually fought the British. I guess he didn't like them. And because there's a direct line of father to son, to father to son, to father to son, to me, to my son, we are, in fact, sovereign people.
Amen.
It's not an arguable point. It's just a fact. Now, is the created ever equal to or greater than the creator? Its creator. The answer is no. So when someone says to people in my lineage, oh, you think you're above the law? It's a fact.
The statute law, the corporate law, not God's law.
No, not God's law.
Yeah.
Absolutely not God's. Absolutely not God's law. Can King Charles, if King Charles murdered somebody, can he be charged with murder?
Absolutely.
Absolutely not. Under the law of the statutes. Can he be charged? The only people that can charge him would be other kings, other queens, other monarchs. If
if I were to do something heinous and fully admitted it, could a current court that we're familiar with today adjudicate the matter? Technically, legally, no. It would take a court of my peers, which would be other American men and women who are by birthright sovereign. Of course, that doesn't stop street justice from taking over, but nonetheless, I'm just talking about points of law only. The statute courts, the courts that we're familiar with today, with the exception of what you mentioned earlier, John, in Texas about we're converting this to a common law court. In the old days, you had different buildings that you went to. If you were looking for a decision in Admiralty Court, you went to that building over there. If you were looking for something in American common law court, you went to this building over here in the old days. This building over here for American common law court, you don't find, I mean, it's there, but it's, nobody occupies it. Back to you. I've talked too much.
Okay. Did you have any other questions?
Yes, I said that I had several. So actually, you were talking tonight also about the acceptance of an attorney or them trying to appoint an attorney. So I just want to throw a thought out there of something that I did a number of years ago. I went to be arraigned, and I told them that I thought I should be able to get a public defender. And I had already filed at that point in time a federal lawsuit against a municipal court judge, against the mayor, some police officers, the chief of police, et cetera. And the prosecutor told the court, this gentleman doesn't need a public defender. He's well capable of handling the case himself. Well, I argued that I did have a right to a public defender, so they agreed, and they sent me and provided me an application. I brought them back an application at about Friday at 4 p.m. in the afternoon that was blank, and they told me that I hadn't filled it out. I said that I had thoroughly read it, looked up some things, and determined that I might incriminate myself if I filled out the application. They said this was unheard of, and you couldn't get a public defender without an application, and they didn't see why it might incriminate me. So I told them that I needed to speak to an attorney. If that was what they were claiming, then I needed to speak to an attorney about that. So to make a long story short, that went back and forth for quite a while, a number of months. They then threatened to try me in absentia, et cetera, and I wouldn't agree to that, and I challenged that. And finally, the case got dropped. They had a lot of other cases, and I guess I was just taking up too much time. But I felt that it was a legitimate question, although apparently it had never been done before in that county. It was a legitimate question. Now, there was a little more detail and a little more conversation about it when I brought the application back, and they said, well, it's only an application, you're not getting an attorney. I said, well, then why would I want to give this information out, because you previously told me that with an attorney, anything I said was confidential and it didn't go anywhere else. But now you're telling me it's only an application for an attorney, therefore this information could go somewhere else. And I tied them up in a whole bunch of knots. Now, do you find that an appropriate way to deal with the courts? Because you're talking tonight in two or three times about the taking of an attorney or how to get rid of an attorney, et cetera, et cetera. So I'd like to hear your comments on that.
Remember, the Office of Public Defender, most of those are working pro bono. Some of them do. There was a public defender that was assigned to a defendant last year that they had a 3-day trial and sentencing. Was supposed to be this last month on the 12th, but they what happened was that all of a sudden he got a bill for $26,800.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, and this is from the public defender. Right now is that's being argued with the court. I think the most, as I mentioned a little earlier, the most eloquent response I've ever heard was, "Your Honor, I have to object. You, I don't believe you have the authority to make that statement." The judge says, "Certainly I do." I says, "Your Honor, I have a question." And he says, "What is it? Does the Constitution stand in this court?" And before you answer, because if it does, then you have the right to hear this case, and under the Sixth Amendment, I have the right to choose my own counsel. But if the Constitution doesn't stand in this court, then I don't have the right to choose my own counsel, and you don't have the right to hear this case. So, in light of the aforementioned, does the Constitution stand in this court? And he allowed him to not take the attorney that the court had assigned. And this gentleman actually, in the three remaining days of the trial, changed his counsel twice and without a single peep from the judge.
Mm-hmm.
I learn a lot of new things every day, every week, every month, every year. And there are people that are far, far wiser than I am, far more knowledgeable. And it's my honor and privilege to listen to what they have to say.
Thank you. The topic that you were talking about regarding the prescriptions and the fact that that memorandum doesn't apply to the VA and may or may not apply in certain other instances where medical services are rendered. Do you know the reasoning behind that? Because I have found that recently prescriptions are now being written for 180 days, but they're fillable for up to a year. But if you want to use them up in 6 months, then you must go back and see the doctor in order to get them written again. So it would seem to me that the length of prescriptions is lengthening rather than shortening.
A few years back, there was a trend where the copay, and this was started by those dusty old fogies that are over the age of 55. And mm-hmm. I know you're not one of those, so I'm not going to cast any aspersions on you. It was murder turned 23. I don't know what I'm going to do when I hit 26. But it was a function of insurance when those who were on limited incomes had to start paying that copay because they were going in every 30 days to get the prescription renewed. They've got the doctors to finally start writing ones for 60 and then 90 days. So they only, and in certain cases, there were certain prescriptions. Originally, it was 7 or 10 days for some narcotics that could qualify as recreational pharmaceuticals. And what happened was they started writing them for 30 days and then the 60 and then the 90 days so that they only had to make one $10 copay for it. And what happened was that the military operates under its own charter, and its medical staff operate under the charter of the military. And there's a the civilian population acts underneath the FDA. You'll find that there are certain drugs and things and procedures that are available to the military that are not available to the rank and files American people. And notice I carefully corrected my word before I said the C word there. They're trying to well-meaning legislators with the noblest of intent are breaking the rules and committing felonies from the legislature. they don't have the right to say a doctor can or can't prescribe this or that. And for around the turn of the last century, the reason a prescription was written was so that the pharmacist would know exactly what the intent of the prescriber was. There wasn't a legal reason requiring